This is the Troubles podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. We just left off as Bobby Sands and the prisoners decided on a second hunger strike. Morale was low in the prison once the decision was made for this strike. O'Rourke writes in his book that there was a lot of correspondence between OC on the outside of May's prison and OC on the inside. The OC on the outside, while not exactly against the strike, wanted to make it clear that this time there would be deaths, and to quote O'Rourke, they made it absolutely clear that they believed that deaths were certain, and if any hesitation to die on part of the hunger strikers resulted in last-minute vacillation, the campaign would be dealt a potentially mortal blow. The options were clear. If we still wanted to go on hunger strike, we had to realise that it was die or kill the struggle. In this way, whoever chose to take part in the strike knew the amount of pressure they would be under. The official date for the strike to begin was March 1, 1981, and O'Rourke writes in his book that once the decision was made, Bobby's demeanour changed, from the bubbly, energetic individual to a more sombre one. As Bobby would be the first person to begin the hunger strike, he was coming to terms with the fact that he would have to die. There was a slim chance that the British government would concede and give in to the prisoners' demands, but this was not expected to happen, and definitely not expected to happen before the first death. This strike put the British government in a difficult position. We've already established that force feeding is not an option, as it can be construed as a form of torture. The British government had the following options. They could give in to the demands of the prisoners and restore special category status. This would put them in an awkward position, showing that crime does indeed pay. They could hope that the will of the strikers would break and that the strike would fizzle out by itself. Or they could allow the strikers to die and argue that the men are killing themselves for nothing. On the side of the IRA, there would be some changes to this hunger strike after the lessons learned from the first one. Instead of all the men going on hunger strike together, they would stagger it by 2 weeks. There were a few reasons for this. One being that the strikes would drag out for a longer period of time and allow for maximum pressure to be put on the British government. O'Rourke explains that there's a more significant reason. Instead of all the prisoners reaching a critical life or death point together, they would reach it one at a time. This one-man-at-a-time approach would put an immense amount of pressure on the hunger striker not to let down his fellow strikers and the striker who just died before him. The strikers would also not be allowed to take part in any negotiations unless their OC, who was now Bic McFarlane, was present. Bic would then insist that Gerry Adams and Danny Morrison be present at any talks with the British government or Northern Irish officials. This would help prevent the breakdown in the command structure that occurred during the first strike. Just to clarify who Danny Morrison and Gerry Adams were, Danny was an IRA member who would eventually act as the spokesperson for Bobby Sands. Gerry Adams has continually denied being a member of the IRA, and at this time Adams was the vice president of the political party Sinn Féin, who were considered the political wing of the IRA. The second strike began on March 1, 1981, which was the fifth anniversary of the beginning of the blanket protests. O'Rourke issued a lengthy statement which was designed to, quote, stir nationalists and persuade them to join our cause. Again, I mention this in nearly every episode, but it is important to remember how important PR was to the IRA. They had a number of aims with this strike, but they also wanted to draw as many people towards their cause, especially the nationalists in Northern Ireland, who were more aligned with the nationalist political party, SDLP, who were a non-violent party. They wanted to draw some of the more moderate nationalists into their cause. 1 week before the second strike began, 3,500 people marched in West Belfast in support of the strikes, which was a rather small number. One day after the beginning of the hunger strike, the dirty protests were stopped to allow for maximum attention focusing on the strikers. Bobby Sands was the first man to go on strike. Then 2 weeks later, he was joined by Francis, or Frank Hughes, from Derry. Hughes was serving an 83-year sentence, after he was involved in a shooting with the British SAS, which left one SAS member killed. He began his strike on March 15th. The next two hunger strikers joined on the same day, March 22nd, Patsy O'Hara and Raymond McCreesh. McCreesh was from County Armagh and was sentenced to 14 years in prison for the attempted murder of British soldiers, possession of a rifle and ammunition, and another 5 years for IRA membership. The rifle that was found on him was one of the rifles used in the King's Mills massacre, which was covered in an earlier episode. Patsy O'Hara was from Derry and was imprisoned after being convicted of possessing a hand grenade. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison, and once he arrived, he became OC of the INLA. So he was representing the other Republican paramilitary group, the INLA. This was a small cause of concern for the IRA, because if the first three hunger strikers died, then there would only be an INLA man left, and the IRA felt that they might lose control over the strikes. The INLA were more akin to the original IRA and had a significant socialist lean when compared to the provisional IRA. To counter this, it was then decided that when a man died, he would be replaced with another man straight away. We now have four people on hunger strike, but I'm just going to take a step back now and explain what happened, which may very well have changed the course of the strikes completely. 5 days into the hunger strike, Frank Maguire died. Maguire was an independent Republican MP, which means Member of Parliament, for Fermanagh and South Tyrone. As a result of his death, a by-election was held to determine who would take his place. Frank's brother Noel was debating to run in his stead, but someone in the Republican movement, most likely Bernadette Devlin, had the idea to put Bobby's name forward instead. The idea was approved by the IRA leadership, on the condition that no other nationalists would run alongside him. So the vote wouldn't be split or weakened, as they were going to go up against unionist candidates and they didn't want to risk losing against them. Noel was subsequently advised not to put his name forward via conversations and implied threats.
Well, I withdrew primarily because I have been told that at this moment it's a question of conscience on my part. Bobby Sands, I am informed, his life depends on my withdrawal and his election, and I would not have the life of anybody on my hands.
Do you feel you've been pressured into making this decision?
No, it's on this question, it's a question of conscience, my own conscience.
The campaign to elect Bobby was indeed controversial. Remember, there were very different types of nationalists at the time. There were the ones who supported Sinn Féin, and Sinn Féin supported a violent campaign. But many nationalists in Northern Ireland were completely opposed to violence and supported the other nationalist party, SDLP. SDLP advised its members to boycott this election because of the way in which the IRA had cleared the field and discouraged any other nationalists to stand against Sands. So in the end, Sands went up as the only nationalist candidate against the Unionist Ulster Party candidate, Harry West, for a seat in the British Parliament. The biggest question was, would these SDLP voters, or moderate nationalists, abstain, or would they vote for Sands? With only 9 days to go between Sands being approved and the election date, a massive campaign was undertaken. The campaign slogan was not just to elect Sands, but to save him. Members of Sinn Féin asked the moderate nationalists to lend them their vote, just for this election, to save the life of Bobby Sands. The message was, if you elect Bobby Sands, you'll save his life. An argument was made that if Sands was elected as a Member of Parliament, there was no way the British government would allow him to die. As well as that, if Sands was elected, it was a way of demonstrating mass support to the world, showing that thousands of people in Northern Ireland supported the hunger strikers. So the election came and went, and the prisoners inside May's prison waited to hear the results. They were in an awkward situation because they weren't allowed radios in the prison, but they usually had one small crystal radio smuggled into each wing. I found one source saying that the radios had to be smuggled in rectally, and that it was one of the most uncomfortable items to bring into the prison. So as the men listened, they were also warned not to react once they heard the news, because then the prison guards would know that they had radios. The results were then read out.
Sands, Bobby, anti-H block, I'm a political prisoner, 30,000,
yeah!
492, West, Henry W., Ulster Unionist, 29,046. And I declare that Bobby Sands has been duly elected to serve as a member for the third constituency.
I would like to thank all our election workers and supporters who worked so hard over the last fortnight, and who, despite intimidation from so-called security forces, did their best and stood up and were counted. And I would like to thank the 30,496 voters in Fermanagh, South Tyrone, who stood by the prisoners and who give Maggie Thatcher her answer today, that we, on behalf of the Irish people, will not accept the situation in the Hitch Block, and that we demand an immediate end to that intolerable situation.
O'Rourke writes in his book that Bic McFarlane was quietly listening to the radio when he heard the news that Sands had been elected, and there was a quiet jubilation in the prison. Sands had narrowly defeated West by 1,446 votes. Over 30,000 people voted for Sands. This was a massive PR win for the Republican movement, but how was it perceived by the Unionists and Loyalists? Many were shocked. In their eyes, a terrorist had just been elected to Parliament, and their neighbours and friends had voted him in. Unionist MP Ken McGuinness said that in the wake of the Sands election, quote, "I couldn't believe that my Roman Catholic neighbour, whom I'd always treated with a great deal of respect, could then go out and vote for someone who was going to murder me or murder some of my friends, and who was an enemy of this particular community. I just couldn't believe it." Harold McCusker, MP for Upper Ban, said that he, quote, "watched the television channels of this province given up to politicians and clerics apparently so concerned about the civil rights of Sands that they forget the ongoing murder campaign being waged against the rest of the community." So now the hunger strike was being led by Bobby Sands, IRA member and also member of the British Parliament. Of course, Bobby would have no ability to attend Parliament, and even if he was a free man, Sinn Féin members refused to take their seats as they do not recognise the British government's authority. But again, the PR was invaluable, and this significantly boosted the profile of the hunger strikes around the world. It also dealt a large blow to the British government's policy of criminalisation, as it showed the public did not see Sands as a criminal. Thatcher's government had repeated over and over that the Republicans were criminals and no one supported them. This election showed that this wasn't true. Many Republicans believed that the government wouldn't let a sitting MP die. But in the wake of the election results, Thatcher showed no sign of backing down. She considered this blackmail, and O'Rourke writes in his book that Bobby himself didn't believe that the election would change Thatcher's mind. As it stands, we now have four men on hunger strike, and one of them is now a member of the British Parliament. The IRA Army Council were closely monitoring the strikers, and had believed that if the British government had not backed down after the first four men died, then they wouldn't back down at all. In April, Sands was visited by a number of high-profile individuals, including Sheila de Valera and a number of Irish TDs. As well as that, the Pope sent a private secretary to talk with Sands, asking him to end his strike, which he refused. His condition gradually deteriorated. On the 18th of April, Sands was given the last rites in the prison hospital, which is a Catholic tradition issued to somebody shortly before their death. The Army Council on the outside wanted the strike to end if all four men died. But on the inside, the men were determined to continue with the strike and replace the dead men with more strikers. O'Rourke states it as, quote, "Should victory appear on the horizon, then we were duty-bound to go for it." Time was running out for Sands, and it became more and more clear that he intended to die. When an individual on a protracted hunger strike comes close to death, they slip into a coma a few days before dying. At this stage, the family of the striker is allowed to intervene and save their life. But Bobby had given strict instructions to his family not to do so. Here's his mother, Roselyne, talking about not intervening.
Do you think if he does go into a coma, you would give the authorization for him to be intravenously fed?
No, he told me not to. It's a sad thing to say, and I would feel I love my son just like any other mother does. But I wouldn't. I can't. He asked me not to, and I've promised him not to.
After a number of days lapsing in and out of a coma, Bobby Sands died on May the 5th after 66 days on hunger strike.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. The place is Twinbrook, West Belfast, the home of Bobby Sands. In the last hour, the news has filtered through to this community that Bobby Sands has died after 66 days of hunger strike.
O'Rourke writes in Blanket Men that there was absolute silence in the prison, as the men all dealt with their own shock and grief at losing their friend, even though they knew it was coming. At 27, Sands had spent nearly one-third of his life in a prison cell. Outside the prison, there was absolute chaos, with widespread rioting and violence. Unionists were less sympathetic to his death.
Excuse me, sir, can I ask you how you feel about Bobby Sands' death?
The letter. It's your own fault. Nobody wanted me there, he wanted to help them.
Well, I don't think to see anybody down, but it's his own choice for to do so. After all, he's in there for a criminal offence, and it's up to himself, you know.
Sands was buried on the 7th of May, with an estimated 100,000 people attending his funeral. This ended up becoming one of the biggest nationalist demonstrations in Northern Irish history to date. Sands was buried in the Republican Milltown Cemetery in Belfast. His death was broadcast around the world, especially in North America, where there is a large Irish diaspora.
We interrupt our regular program schedule to bring you the following special report from ABC News Washington. Here is Ted Koppel.
Bobby Sands is dead. The 27-year-old member of the Irish Republican Army who went on a protest hunger strike 66 days ago has died. The British Press Office in Belfast announced this evening that Sands died at 1:17 Tuesday morning, Belfast time. That would have been 8:17 p.m. Eastern time here in the United States. Sands, who was serving a 14-year prison term on a weapons possession charge, had been demanding special status as a political prisoner. A number of other Irish Republican Army members, also imprisoned by the British, have joined Sands in his protest, and several of them are also well into a hunger strike.
One documentary I came across explained that the daily bombings and killings that went on in Northern Ireland were not broadcast in the USA. But when the hunger strikers began to die, it made front page news. Is something preventing you from reaching your goals or interfering with your happiness? If so, check out this episode's sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp can assess your needs and match you with a licensed therapist. It isn't a crisis line or a self-help line. With BetterHelp, you can connect with licensed counselors who specialize in a range of issues, including depression, stress, and anxiety. You can send a message to your counselor anytime and schedule weekly phone and video sessions, all from the comfort of your own home. It's also more affordable than traditional offline counseling and offers much more options. Start living a happier life today. As a Troubles podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/troubles. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/troubles. In the wake of Sands' death, the British government remained resolute, with Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Humphrey Atkins, stating, quote, "If Mr. Sands persisted in his wish to commit suicide, that was his choice. The government would not force medical treatment upon him." Thatcher also refused to back down, stating that the hunger strikers were a desperate act to elicit pity. Quote, "Faced with the failure of their discredited cause, the men of violence have chosen in recent months to play what may well be their last card." She said of Bobby Sands, quote, "Mr. Sands was a convicted criminal. He chose to take his own life. It was a choice that his organization did not allow to many of its victims." To the unionists, these deaths were essentially a non-event. In their eyes, the hunger strikers were the people who had caused the deaths of their friends and family. But in the eyes of many nationalists, Sands had just become a martyr, and Thatcher a murderer. The events that happen over the next 2 months following Sands' death are quite crucial, so I'll do my best to explain everything in chronological order. On May the 8th, Joe McDonnell took Sands' place as the next hunger striker. Then just 4 days later, Francis Hughes died after 59 days on hunger strike. Brendan McLaughlin then took Hughes' place. McLaughlin was on hunger strike for 12 days before being taken off because of a perforated ulcer which was causing internal bleeding. He would have suffered immensely and died much earlier than intended, so he was then replaced by Martin Herson. On May 21st, Raymond McLeish and Patsy O'Hara both died after 61 days on hunger strike. Kieran Daugherty then joined the strike 1 day later, replacing Raymond. Kevin Lynch from the INLA then replaced Patsy. O'Rourke writes in Blanket Men that the OC in the prison were now faced with a problem. Four men had already died and had been replaced by four more, with the British government showing no sign of giving in to their demands. So the prisoners decided to escalate things and add more hunger strikers to show that they were not backing down nor were they slowing down. On June 8th, Tom McElwee was the first additional prisoner to go on hunger strike, followed by Paddy Quinn. Then, 3 days later, a general election was held in the Republic of Ireland, in which hunger striker Kieran Daugherty was elected TD for Cavan and Monaghan. Prisoner Paddy Agnew was also elected in Louth. This was another PR success for the Republicans, showing that the people in the Republic of Ireland were taking note. This election was also disastrous for the Irish political party Fianna Fáil. Charles Haughey was a firebrand nationalist who was the Taoiseach of Ireland at the time, but despite being a nationalist, he did not support the hunger strikers' five demands, and many nationalists in the Republic of Ireland were upset at his apathy towards the strikers. And Fianna Fáil lost votes around Ireland as people voted for the H-block prisoners instead. The Republican movement fed on this and propagated the idea that Haughey had sold out his Republican principles and become a collaborator with Thatcher. Haughey is an interesting character though, as back in the 60s he was part of a plot to import arms to help the IRA in Northern Ireland, so he'll probably get his own episode eventually. As a result of the election, Gareth Fitzgerald of Fine Gael ousted Haughey to become Taoiseach, but he was equally as unsympathetic to the hunger strikers. In early June, the British government published proposals that would change their legislation so that prisoners could not become candidates in elections, so that they could avoid the embarrassment that the Bobby Sands election caused. It was also around this time that the Catholic Church and SDLP were making efforts to end the hunger strikes. They did not endorse the five demands of the prisoners, but they wanted to bring an end to the stalemate that was taking place between the prisoners and the British government. O'Rourke writes that they were also putting pressure on family members of the strikers and trying to get them to intervene on medical grounds if a striker fell into a coma. On June 30th, the British government reiterated its stance on the strikers, saying that there would be no political status and no changes to the prison regime. O'Rourke explains in Blanket Men that he was slowly realising that the prisoners' demands were putting the British government in an impossible position, and they would never be able to concede to the terms offered, so more men would continue to die. On the 4th of July, the prisoners released a statement that was trying to step back a small bit, stating that they had no objection to any changes in the prison regime being applied to all prisoners and not just Republicans. 8 men were on hunger strike by this point, so the stakes were high, and inside the prison, they didn't want any more men to die. This statement was well received by many, because it showed that the movement was looking for a way to end the strikes. So on the surface, we have the Catholic Church, SDLP, and the Irish government trying to broker peace. Unbeknownst to them, there were secret talks taking place. Codenamed Mountain Climber, these were negotiations that were taking place between Republican leadership and the British government. The existence of Mountain Climber has been disputed for a long time, and O'Rourke does mention it in the book, but I also have seen it in other sources. It was through this channel that the British government offered a deal in response to the prisoner's statement of July 4th. This deal would have been considered as good as the strikers could possibly have got. I'll just restate what the original demands of the prisoners were. 1. The right not to wear uniform. 2. The right not to do prison work. 3. The right to free association and to organise educational and recreational pursuits. 4. The right to one visit, one letter and one parcel every week. 5. Full restoration of remission lost through the protest. O'Rourke claims there were new terms being offered by the British government through the secret back channel. Here are the terms. 1. All prisoners in Northern Ireland had the right to wear their own clothes at all times once the strike ended. 2. Work would involve self-maintenance activities such as cleaning cells, wings and blocks of a prisoner's area, cooking and washing your own clothes. Education would also be recognised as work. 3. Free association was still a no-go for the British government. They believed that if the prisoners had the freedom to move freely within their wings before being locked into their cell at 8 p.m. every evening, then the prisoners would end up running some part of the prison. They were being offered segregation, which would allow for a certain degree of association inside the prison. Parcels, letters, and visits were already in existence for those who were not striking, so this one was not really a big deal. Remission, which means that a prisoner's sentence could be reduced as much as 50% as a result of good behaviour. Hunger strikes lost all rights to remission, but in this new offer, either half or one-fifth remission was being offered. O'Rourke writes that he was astonished at this offer. He was the public relations officer for the prisoners, so he would have had access to these secret comms that many other Republican prisoners and hunger strikers would not. He was of the opinion that this offer was the best offer that would ever come from the British government. Joe McDonnell was also days away from dying, so if this deal was agreed on, his life and the life of 7 others could be saved. O'Rourke writes that he talked with Bic, and the two agreed that these terms were enough to constitute ending the strike. He also writes that IRA member Danny Morrison had visited the hunger strikers and explained the terms that were being offered through Mountain Climber, and that they had fully accepted them. It should be noted that another source I came across was an interview with hunger striker Paddy Quinn. Quinn's account is different, and he goes on to say that after a discussion about the terms, the strikers voted to continue striking. Here's Paddy talking about that moment.
Then he started talking about, he says, I remember him clearly saying, he says it's like this, lad, we want you to come off the hunger strike. He says, and I can tell you this now, if one of you has come off, or the whole lot of you has come off, he says, nothing will be thought the less of you coming off this hunger strike. He says, we would rather you end this hunger strike today. Tom McElroy stood up. He says, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll have a vote on it. So Tom got up and he says, Paddy, you're the worst here at the table. I know Kieran and Kevin, I'll go down to them after they're in the bed. Confined to the bed, he says, but you are the worst here, so I asked you, what is your decision? Well, do you want this hunger strike to end? I remember saying no. I remember my head, I could hardly keep my head up, but the meeting had gone on for about 15 minutes at this stage. And I decided I wanted to go back to the cell. I just said no. But I remember going back to the cell in the wheelchair. They wheeled me back to it. And I remember a feeling of, I could not describe it, a feeling of great elation, peaceful and contentment. I can't really put the feeling I had, you know, feelings that I felt then going back to that cell. Whether it was because it was as if I crossed a bridge or something. All the fear and all the pressure and all the torture of the hunger strike had gone. And actually, I just said to myself, I'm looking forward to dying now.
O'Rourke wrote that Bic sent a comm to the Army Council on the outside, saying that they were happy to accept these terms, and there was a palpable sense of relief amongst the Republican prisoners. On the afternoon of July 6th, word came back from the Army Council, saying that they were rejecting this offer and that Mountain Climber's proposal offered the basis for a resolution, but more was needed. The IRA Council on the outside was not happy with the lack of free association, and also were not happy with the ambiguity with what constituted prison work. it would appear that they were hoping to get a better offer from the mountain climber back channel. Again, a lot of this account comes from O'Rourke's book, and many Republicans have disagreed with these claims, including Bic McFarlane and Danny Morrison, saying that O'Rourke is trying to put some blame on the death of the strikers on the IRA, when in their opinion, it solely rests on the British government. O'Rourke claims that the strikers didn't have a say in the matter, and it was the OC on the outside who had the final say, whereas Bic McFarlane says that the prisoners wanted something concrete from the British government before they would agree on ending the strikes. In the words of Bic, quote, "We were desperate for a solution. Any deal that went some way to meeting the five demands would have been taken. If it was confirmed in writing, we'd have grabbed it. There was never a deal. There was never a take it or leave it option at all." O'Rourke writes that Bic sent a comm to the council imploring them to find a quick solution. But before this comm had reached them, Joe died on July 8th after 61 days on strike. On July 9th, Pat McGeown joined the strike, replacing Joe. After Joe died, any hope for an immediate end to the hunger strike died with him, and the line of communication with Mountain Climber disappeared. On July 13th, the prisoners received the shocking news that Martin Herson had died. He had only been on hunger strike for 46 days, so in theory he had at least two or three more weeks to go before reaching the critical point. It turns out that Herson had an infection in his stomach. He couldn't keep water down after 40 days and rapidly deteriorated after that. Most of the sources I came across say that he suffered an agonising death.
Martin never could hold the water down. He went breathing quick. But I could hear him shouting this night. His brother was in the cell with him. I could hear his brother shouting, "Martin." I could hear Martin shouting, I could hear him shouting, "The lights is out. The lights is out. Somebody put the lights on." And he kept on shouting about the lights. And I could hear his brother shouting his name, "Martin, Martin," you know. And on, and then he got more incoherent. You know, he was just shouting, doing a lot of shouting out through the night. Same thing again. I got quiet for about 20 minutes and then I could hear the commotion. You know, taking Martin away. Martin was dead. I knew he was dead.
Had the leadership in the prison known he had an infection, he would have been pulled off the strike. Matt Devlin joined the strike to replace Herson that same day. On July 18th, there was rioting outside the British Embassy in Dublin. Around 200 people were injured, but there were no deaths. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, bombings and shootings continued. On July 31st, Paddy Quinn's mother had requested medical intervention to save the life of her son after he spent 47 days on hunger strike. Paddy was the first hunger striker whose family had requested an intervention. Here's his mother talking.
"I had my mind made up, I sort of think then. He says, I want him off the hunger strike. Eugene says, are you sure about this? He says, should you not see the rest of the family? John or Lawrence or somebody?" So I says, no. There's no time for that.
Then on August 1st, Kevin Lynch died after 71 days on hunger strike. The following day, Kieran Doherty died after 73 days striking. Liam McCloskey then joined the strike. 1 week later, on August 8th, Thomas McElwee died after 62 days striking. That following week, two more men joined the hunger strike. On August 20th, Michael Devine died after 60 days on hunger strike. Michael was the 10th and final striker to die. That same day, Pat McGeown's family agreed to medically save his life and take him off hunger strike. Bernard Fox and Hugh Carville subsequently joined the strike. We're now getting into September, and though men continued to replace the hunger strikers who had died, the families of hunger strikers made it clear that if their sons fell into a coma while striking, they would medically intervene to save their life and end the strike. The end was near for the hunger strike. On September 4th, Matt Devlin's family intervened and took him off hunger strike after 52 days. On September 6th, the family of Lawrence McKeown intervened after 70 days on hunger strike and he was taken off. Though two more people joined the strike in late September, the strike was essentially finished and was officially called off on October 3rd. The pathologist's report for many of the bodies described their cause of death as self-imposed starvation, but this was soon changed to starvation after the families protested. In total, the hunger strike had lasted for 7 months, from March the 1st to October the 3rd. In that time, 23 men went on hunger strike and 10 lost their lives. Of that 10, most men were in their mid-20s, with the youngest being Thomas McElwee and Patsy O'Hara at 23, and the oldest being Joe McDonnell at 29. So after this significant loss of life, were the demands of the hunger strikers ever met? Within 2 years of the hunger strike, the British government had met most of the prisoners' demands. Jim Pryor was appointed the new Secretary of State in Northern Ireland, and he gave a series of concessions to prisoners, which amounted to the substance of political status without conceding the principle. This move deeply upset unionists. There is no doubt that the hunger strikes paved the way for Sinn Féin to harness the power of politics. After the electoral success of Bobby Sands, the Republican movement moved towards a strategy of the Armalite and the ballot box, which basically means using violence alongside politics. Before the hunger strikes, Sinn Féin had not fully considered a political means to securing a fully independent Ireland. And in the aftermath of the strikes, support for SDLP slowly started to decline in favour of Sinn Féin. And in 2001, Sinn Féin became the largest nationalist party in Northern Ireland. As of writing, it has now been 40 years since the strikes began, and the events which went on in early July are still hotly debated, with some asking the question, could the strikes have ended after the first four deaths? O'Rourke's book poises that the IRA Army Council unnecessarily prolonged the strikes, and that the prisoners had little to no say in the matter. This claim has been heavily disputed amongst Republicans. Some say there never was an offer, and that it was always the strikers who decided to continue striking or not. For Republicans, the 10 hunger strikers who have died have gone on to receive saint-like status, which echoes that given to the men who died during the 1916 Easter Rising. They gave their lives for their cause, and there's no doubt that the hunger strikes led to an uptick in membership to the provisional IRA. O'Rourke's perspective is that some of the men were faced with an insurmountable amount of pressure to not be the man to break the strike, so they went to their deaths, not exactly willingly, but rather because they were trapped. That perspective would be considered deeply unsettling to the Republican movement. The British press declared the end of the strikes as a victory for Thatcher, saying, quote, "The government had overcome the hunger strikes by a show of resolute determination not to be bullied." Thatcher became a figure of immense hate amongst Republicans, and the IRA targeted her just 3 years later in the Brighton bomb attack, narrowly avoiding killing her. Each year, there are a number of tributes made to the hunger strikers. This episode is being written in August 2021, and just recently a video did the rounds on social media of the unveiling of a mural for INLA man Michael Devine. In the video, you can see masked men firing shots from what looks like fake assault rifles into the sky as part of that tribute. As well as that, a number of prominent Sinn Féin members in both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland paid tribute to the anniversary of the death of hunger striker Thomas McElwee. This caused controversy online amongst critics of Sinn Féin and unionists, as McElwee had firebombed a shop, which led to the death of 26-year-old mother Yvonne Dunlop. There are many memorials to the hunger strikers in Ireland and also around the world. One of the more interesting memorials is in the country of Iran. The government in Tehran, Iran, changed the name of the street where the British Embassy sits from Churchill Street to Bobby Sands Street. As a result of this, the British Embassy had to relocate their entrance so that letters addressed to them didn't have Bobby Sands written on every address. To some, The hunger strikes showed the sheer fanaticism of the Republican movement. Here's a quote from prominent loyalist Billy Wright, who described how he felt when watching the blanket men in the early days of the strike. Quote, "I knew the significance of what I was witnessing. If here was a movement that would inflict on itself so much violence for its own ideology, then what would it not do to other human beings? I knew then it had to be resisted." To others, the 10 men who died will forever be remembered as those who gave the ultimate sacrifice for the liberation of their country. Thanks, and see you next time. The Patreon is a great way to show your support. I release the episodes there early, and I also put out a companion video with each episode. On Patreon, the episodes are also completely ad-free, and you can listen on your own personal RSS feed on your podcast player. I'll also be posting there the full show notes for every episode. You can support the podcast over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Alternatively, if you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do that over at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or simply telling your friends. It all helps.